of the United States said that it was the first hatchet job on organized labor. I didn't mean it that way. I just meant it to be telling the story the way it was, in the sense that we used thousands of union documents to portray how organized labor uses compulsory dues money for political ends. And that's my that is my background with interest in unionism, because shortly thereafter I moved to Texas from Washington, D.C., and living in Texas, one hardly hears the word phrase organized labor or the word unions, because we are a right-to-work state, for which I'm very gratified, and it's just a different atmosphere. I might mention that I'm involved with several people in putting together a new computer database that will be an international database service, can be accessed by anyone in the world, and at any time of the day, 24 hours a day. And the interesting aspect about starting a new business of this type, that our business plan shows that we'll probably have to employ only 14 persons to service potentially millions of businessmen in the world, because we'll be using a computer. And therefore, not only are we not concerned with employees, we're certainly not concerned with unions. And this may be what the future holds, not only for unions in general, but for employee relations in general. Our first speaker today, whose topic is going to be the public sector, is Joseph Morris, and I can't think of a finer expert on the subject than Mr. Morris. He's a graduate of the University of Chicago, where he received both his undergraduate and his JD degree at the law school. He practiced, he was in private practice in Chicago for a number of years, specializing in constitutional law and civil rights. And in 1981, he was appointed by President Reagan, with the consent of Don Devine, to be the general counsel of the U.S. Office of Personnel Management. In essence, he is a lawyer who handles labor relations for the government. You might say he is even the president's labor relations lawyer. Mr. Morris.
Thank you very much, Doug Caddy. In the spirit of personal disclosure that characterized the previous panel, I guess I should tell you that I once applied for membership in the United Steelworkers, and my application was rejected. So as far as I know, I've never been a member of a union. Well, let me open with a short story. Two men were up in a balloon, a hot air balloon, lofting along over open country. And the day was foggy and the day grew dark. They lost sight of landmarks on the ground and eventually knew not where they were. So they let some gas out of the bag, brought the balloon down low until they were hovering over a meadow and they could see through the clouds to the ground below. And finally they espied, walking across the meadow, some country yeoman. The two fellows in the gondola of the balloon called down, "Hello down there!" And the man on the ground looked up. And the fellow in the gondola called down and said, "Where are we?" And the man on the ground looked up, pointed up, and replied, "You're up in a balloon!" Whereupon one fellow in the gondola turned to his confrère and said, "You know, that guy down there is a lawyer." And his colleague said, "How on earth can you tell that from up here?" And the first fellow in the balloon replied, "Because the information that he gave us was absolutely accurate and absolutely useless." Well, I put you on fair warning. We're about to turn to that part of the program where you're going to hear from at least a couple of lawyers. Let me also bring you, by the way, from Washington, a report from the front, speaking of lawyers and courtrooms. Late last week, Assistant General Counsel Cliff White and I stopped by the United States District Courthouse in Washington, where the Watergate trials took place, to watch a bit of the current trial going on, in which the parties are Willis Cardo, Spotlight Magazine, the Liberty Lobby on the one hand, and Bill Buckley and National Review on the other. We went to watch a milestone event in the history of the law, somebody cross-examining Bill Buckley. It was Mark Lane, counsel for Cardo, doing so. And it was an amazing encounter between the law and an individual. As proceedings, legal proceedings, wended their way through the course of the day, as Buckley sat in the witness stand and the lawyers would bicker in front of the judge, every time the judge would rule, there would be instantaneous judicial review from the witness box. For example, Mark Lane, Carto's counsel, would say, "I move that this document be admitted into evidence." Dan Mahoney, National Review's counsel, would say, "No objection." The judge would say, "It shall be entered into evidence," and the voice from the witness box would say, "Okay." there was a moment when Lane said, "Objection," Mahoney said, "Irrelevant," the judge said, "Overruled," Buckley said, "That's good." there was a moment when Lane asked him, one of the issues in the lawsuit is attorney's fees. "Are you paying attorney's fees? How much? To whom?" Buckley replied, "Wendell's and Marks." "No relation, Mr. Lane." And then there was the moment when Lane, trying to prejudice the District of Columbia jury, contrasting Mr. Buckley's views on Jesse Jackson with those of other scoundrels, said, "So you call Jesse Jackson a fraud and a lout?" "Yes, that's right," Bill Buckley said. "Well, did you ever call Adolf Hitler a fraud?" Pause. Buckley replied, "Calling Adolf Hitler a fraud is like calling Stalin a tease." that's the news from the front. It is an extraordinary honor for me personally to be called upon to speak before you today. Here am I from Gary, Indiana, speaking before Professor Hutt, Professor Kirk, two men who have students and people that they've influenced they don't even know exist. Here I am talking about labor law before Reed Larson and Deputy Secretary Danny Boggs, for God's sakes, and the previous speakers and all of you in the room. I feel as if I've been called on to brief Noah about floods, but I will do my best. One fellow who was here today, a fellow Philadelphian, who's very important to me, Don Devine, and I met for the first time in 1971 or 72 when I was an undergraduate at the University of Chicago, and Milton Friedman brought me to a Philadelphia Society meeting. And there I saw Don Devine and was thrilled by the brain power and the personality and the drive of that man, somebody who clearly was marked to bring the world of ideas into the arena, clearly somebody who would be both a man of thought and a man of action. And so it was 10 years or so later, in 1981, President Reagan elected, Don Devine installed as the director of the Civil Service, that he telephoned me in my law office in Chicago and asked me if I would be willing to come to serve in the administration of President Reagan as the general counsel of the Civil Service. And I assented, and it's been an extraordinary learning experience and a practical experience for me. And what I want to do today is to share with you a few things that I have learned about the management of the federal sector, and in particular about labor management relations in the federal sector, and to expose you to some insights that I have gained in this process, coming to the government as a layman, as someone not from Washington, as someone who is very much part of the private sector and very much looking forward to returning to the private sector in due course. The United States government, it is no surprise to you, is the largest employer in the nation. Its civilian workforce, exclusive of military uniformed personnel, runs just about 2 million. Of these 2 million civilian personnel in the civil service, 1.6 million are white-collar employees, about 0.4 million, 400,000 are blue-collar employees. And these 2 million civil servants do not include roughly 700,000 employees in the Postal Service, a large majority of whom are blue-collar personnel. Of the 2 million civil servants, half are in the Department of Defense. The other half are in all of the other myriad departments and agencies of the government put together. Now, in terms of collective bargaining, the civil service system admits of collective bargaining over most aspects of what are called working conditions. And working conditions is a broad array of issues that pretty much excludes nothing but wages and benefits. But bargaining is required over the impact and implementation even of civil service regulations promulgated on a government-wide basis by the Office of Personnel Management. In the Postal Service, collective bargaining reaches even further. It extends not only to working conditions, but also to wages. And although it does not extend to the particular taxonomy of the retirement and insurance benefits programs, which are administered centrally for the entire government, including the Postal Service, by OPM, it does extend to the employer contributions to those fringe benefit programs. So the collective bargaining in the Postal Service has a much broader reach. In terms of union representation in the federal sector, virtually all blue-collar personnel in the civil service are represented by unions. It's close to a 90% figure. About two-thirds of all white-collar personnel in the civil service are represented by unions. Now, I must draw a careful distinction between union representation on the one hand in exclusive bargaining relationships, and that's what these arrangements are, and union membership on the other. For while union representation has been on a steady, pretty steady increase, much now decelerated, but still an increase over the last two decades, union membership has been, by and large, on a fairly steady decline, particularly in the last decade, particularly in the last half decade. Now, the government does not maintain union membership statistics for the obvious constitutional reasons. We do keep track of representational statistics, but the unions themselves have been fairly forthcoming in complaining about their plights of membership and the financial problems that result. 135 different labor organizations represent federal employees in these bargaining units around the government. By far the largest of them is the major AFL-CIO federal sector component, the American Federation of Government Employees, whose representation rate in the government is up to some 700,000 civil servants. That's exclusive of the Postal Service, which has its own series of postal unions. The AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees, AFL-CIO, whose president, Kenneth Blaylock, is also the head of the public sector, the public employee department of the AFL-CIO, represents some 700,000 employees. There are close to 2,400 bargaining units around the government. Now, there are really substantially fewer than 100 major government departments and agencies. By this statistic, 2,400 different bargaining units, you can see that the government is highly fragmented in terms of these bargaining arrangements. In the Department of Defense, for example, there are roughly 1,500 different bargaining units spread across the department, which means that it is virtually impossible for the people at the top of DOD management to get a handle on what kinds of bargaining arrangements are being undertaken through the it's virtually impossible for them to know what their own managers are doing out in the field as they undertake these bargaining relationships across the country. Well, the fragmentation that exists in terms of these bargaining arrangements is only the tip of the iceberg in terms of the fragmentation that afflicts the management of the federal personnel system in its basic architecture. It begins at the beginning. The board of directors, for God's sakes, of the government as manager is the United States Congress. 535 different voices where the labor component of the labor management equation has very substantial representation, far beyond the one seat that UAW has on the board of directors of a major motor car manufacturer. Of course, the president is the principal manager of the executive branch. But in this post-Watergate, post-Civil Service Reform Act era, the institutions and instruments of personnel management and labor management within the executive branch itself is highly fragmented and fractionalized. Some of you may be struck by the fact that isn't it a curious thing that after serving for 4 years as director of the civil service, as director of OPM, Don Devine had to be reappointed and face reconfirmation. And it was in that reconfirmation that our political opponents in the Senate defeated his reappointment. Very few heads of government departments and agencies, once appointed, have term appointments that limit their service. The Secretary of State, once appointed, as we saw, for example, in the case of Secretary Kissinger, can serve from president to president, so long as he sustains the confidence of the president. There are no limits on the amount of time, so long as presidential confidence is retained, on the part of most agency heads. The director of the FBI, for example, J. Edgar Hoover, was confirmed once in the 1920s and never confirmed again. He served with the confidence of presidents generation after generation. But that ended with Watergate. And with Watergate, a term of 10 years was imposed upon the directorship of the FBI. And for some reason, this post-Watergate logic carried into Jimmy Carter's process of civil service reform, to which I'll turn in a moment, and a 4-year term was imposed in that process upon the director of OPM. His term dies at the end of 4 years. Not so the deputy director of OPM, but the director of OPM, yes. And therein lies a tale into which we shall not enter today. The Civil Service Reform Act of 1978 abolished the old Civil Service Commission, 3 members bipartisan, and replaced it with the following constellation of bodies: OPM, the Office of Personnel Management, headed by a single director, a political appointee, part of the president's administration, charged with political accountability for making personnel management policy. OPM is the regulatory body. We make the policies, we make the rules that govern the rest of the civil service, and we administer the basic civil service management functions of competitive examinations for purposes of staffing the government. We run the compensation, the pay systems, the insurance, health insurance, life insurance, retirement programs. We run the personnel background investigations on most civil servants whom the FBI does not screen, and by the way, that means we do the vast majority of them. We run government-wide training programs for everything from senior executives down to clerical personnel. We run something that's on the order of a war college for senior managers at Charlottesville. We call it the Federal Executive Institute. And we superintend the president's, the executive branch's labor relations program. We are labor relations counsel to all of the departments and agencies of the government. That's the Office of Personnel Management. Then there's the Merit Systems Protection Board, the MSPB, 3 members, bipartisan, appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, a far-flung network of hearing examiners all around the country. They hear appeals by employees of the federal government who are aggrieved by the way in which they have been treated, denied a raise, denied a promotion, canned for bad performance, fired for misconduct, removed in a layoff. All of those things, mere suspensions, all of those things may be appealed to the Merit Systems Protection Board as of right. There are 2 layers of review within the Merit Systems Protection Board, and then there is a right of appeal as of right to the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit from decisions by the MSPB adverse to employees. Then there's the Federal Labor Relations Authority, 3 members appointed by the president, bipartisan. They preside over a nationwide set of hearing examiners and arbitrators selected under negotiated agreements. The arbitrators selected under negotiated agreements have identical jurisdiction with the MSPB over these appeals of layoffs and firings and disciplinary actions and so forth. The FLRA also functions as the NLRB for the federal sector, adjudicating disputes between unions as unions and agencies as management or as employers. Then there is the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission. Obviously, it pre-existed the Civil Service Reform Act, but under the Civil Service Reform Act, the responsibility for the civil rights and affirmative action programs in the government that used to belong to the Civil Service Commission were transferred to the EEOC. Then there is the Federal Sector Impasses Panel, which sits to resolve disputes between agencies and unions when they can't reach agreement in collective bargaining. Then there is the Foreign Service Labor Management Relations Board, which performs three of the functions that I've just described, and I won't specify them for you because that would get boring, for the Foreign Service part of the civil service system. Every one of these bodies has its own general counsel or special counsel. There's also an Office of Government Ethics, which is technically part of OPM, with its own director, deputy director, and chief counsel, that superintends the ethics, the post-Watergate ethics functions of the civil service. So you can see that what has replaced the Civil Service Commission is a very impressive and highly puzzling complex architecture of entities where once there were three Senate-confirmed presidential appointees, there are now over a dozen Senate-confirmed presidential appointees. And when you ask, when things go wrong, who is responsible for all of this, it's very hard to answer the question. And that's the point. Let me share with you three core insights into what we've learned from all of this in the last 7 years since civil service reform, and in particular in the last 4 years of President Reagan's administration. Key insight number one, despite this morass, this institutional and policy morass that I have described, as Don Devine told you at lunch today, individuals really can make a difference. Beginning with President Reagan himself, in 1981, in August, Don had been on the job a few months. I hadn't even been on the job a month yet. A gauntlet was laid down before President Reagan by members of a now defunct, deceased labor organization called the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, who, like many labor unions before them, which still exist in the federal sector, who have survived, really didn't take very seriously the statutes that prohibit strikes against the federal government, that prohibit unions from bargaining with the federal government if they conduct strikes, and which require all employees of the United States government to swear upon oath that they will not strike against the government. And the reason why the union didn't particularly take those statutes seriously is because the government for a long, long time had not taken those statutes seriously, had not enforced them. There had been quiet strikes before. There had been quiet amnesties granted to striking employees before, until PATCO struck in August of 1981. And I think that it is fair to say that President Reagan's response to that strike generated something of a watershed for labor relations in this country, not just in the public sector, but across the board. For once, here was someone in that moment, in a moment that set the tone for so much of what the Reagan administration has been thereafter and has perceived to be on the good side of the ledger thereafter by the American people. The president said, no, we take the law seriously, and above all, we take oaths seriously. And if these people go on strike, I will ask them politely to come back. I will give them 72 hours to do so. And if they don't, they're fired. He said it. He meant it. And 11,500 air traffic controllers were fired. And the government ceased negotiating with PATCO. And the government went before the FLRA and moved to decertify the union as a bargaining agent for any employees of the United States government. And by God, we won. 3 years later, when all the litigation was completed, and there, by the way, there are still a few cats and dogs of cases out there, 11,200 of the firings had been sustained. The other 300 were people who really were on vacation or really, really did get sick or whatever at the time of the strike. The union was decertified, the union was dissolved, and that action by President Reagan change the way people think about the laws, the oaths, and labor management relations. I submit to you it was a catalyzing moment for changing the way we think. And that was so much of the mission of President Reagan in the government writ large and Don Devine in the civil service that they carried with them in 1981. It was to, as Bill Buckley once wrote in Up From Liberalism, stand across the tide of history and shout, stop. It was to change directions 180 degrees. And yes, Don Devine had to be confrontational in doing so. President Reagan had to be confrontational in doing so. Not everybody was pleased, but the course of the boat did change. The direction may not be a perfect 180 degrees, but there was a change, and that was a first in our history. Yes, individuals make a difference. You heard at lunch Don talking about the health insurance program, the difference he made there, the difference he made in layoff policy, the difference he made in coming up with a pay-for-performance plan, the difference he made in changing our workplace charity solicitation system, the combined federal campaign, which by 1980 had become an engine for funding all kinds of political advocacy and legal defense funds and so forth. And after 4 years of litigation now, including a case that we took to the Supreme Court this last spring, we have finally upheld in our desire to change policy to reach a position in which this workplace charity drive is returned to a means of support for traditional health and welfare charity and is no longer an engine for funding political activity. What lies ahead in terms of having to make differences? At lunch, Don Devine touched briefly on the civil service retirement system. That is a major problem, not just its unfunded liability. There is one major opportunity, there is one major danger in the approaches that Congress is now taking with the administration as we look toward reform of the civil service retirement system. Since January of 1984, all newly employed civil servants are no longer in the old civil service retirement system. They're in some new civil service retirement plan. The old one with the big unfunded liability is to go out of business. But even 2 years into this process, we still have not shaped the new retirement plan. What will it be? We're in negotiations with the Hill on that issue right now. We're looking at something on the order of, and I will use a shorthand here, a transportable kind of IRA, individual retirement accounts that are put together essentially as defined contribution as opposed to defined benefit plans. That's what the administration would like to see. Now, that's important because if anything like that comes into existence, it can serve not just to resolve the liability problems of the civil service retirement system and for once draw a line around the bills the taxpayers have to pay, but it could also serve as a model for drawing lines around the bills the taxpayers have to pay for some other kinds of retirement programs as well. And dare I breathe the words, Social Security. But it's an interesting experiment in coming up with something like IRAs for a major public sector, the major public sector retirement system, the nation's third largest entitlements program. I said there is a danger. The danger is that Congress is toying with the idea of requiring the funds in the pool of the civil service retirement plan to be invested in the private sector. Now, currently, they're lent to the Treasury. We buy Treasury securities with them. Now, there is, at the threshold, a certain seductive attractiveness, this idea of investing this money in the private sector. Sure, privatize it. But stop and think about that. You have billions upon billions of dollars suddenly plowed into the private sector capital markets. Somebody owns those investments. Somebody votes the shares to elect directors and determine company policy on the basis of those investments. And somebody can suddenly disinvest or shift investments to favored firms or favored industries and take them away from disfavored firms and disfavored industries on the basis of, well, whatever grounds of decision. Therein lies the potential for a major governmental intrusion into the private capital markets that can be deeply perilous indeed. Well, insight one, individuals make a difference. Insight two, very quickly, the fragmentation that I have described is not accidental. The process of breaking power and therefore responsibility into many little discrete chunks and spreading them over many separate institutions and setting those institutions in competition or in conflict with one another has three important effects. One, It's a picnic for lawyers. The system becomes a system of litigation, of adversarial relationships, where due process, form, procedure take precedence over substance and policy and results. Now, I'm a big fan of due process when the rights of the government are coming up against the rights, when the power of the government is coming up against the rights of individuals. But setting up an adversarial system within management, where the components of management become adversaries and competitors with each other, is nonsense. But the second result of that is to fragment responsibility within the executive branch and make it more difficult for the president to control management policymaking within the executive branch. The third consequence of it is that it makes it impossible to identify who is responsible, who is accountable for actions that are taken. That certainly benefits Congress. Congress is the ultimate beneficiary of that because it means that when things go wrong, they can't be politically visited upon Congress. But it also serves the interests of powerful institutional presences in the nation's capital, the institutions of the career bureaucracy, foremost among them. Basically, the Iron Triangle itself, the Hill and Hill staffs, private sector special interest groups, and the bureaucracies of the agencies, which relationship is even more shielded from a public disability. Finally, what is revealed in this experience is that the core theme of Jimmy Carter's civil service reform experiment is just plain wrong. There is a major error here. The Carter idea behind civil service reform is that all that is wrong with government is that it isn't managed well. If we could simply set up a more rational, more clearly defined management structure, something better than this old, century-old civil service commission system, then we could make government work better, make government more efficient, and that will cure the problems of public dissatisfaction, of malaise with the government. That insight was wrong. One reason is the reason stated by Will Rogers in that memorable throwaway line, "Be thankful you don't get all the government you pay for." But the second reason it was wrong, and the second reason is really the Reaganite insight. The problem with government is not that it's inadequately managed. The problem with government is that the tasks that are assigned to it, the tasks that government managers are asked to carry out, are the wrong tasks. There will be no civil service, there will be no real civil service reform, and there will be no real, really cogent government management until such time as government does different things, most importantly, until government does fewer things. And that is the real lesson to be learned from the failures to date of civil service reform. The employee organizations in the government, by and large, have a minimal interest in the success of civil service reform. Their interest is in the minimization of the control of a president, any president, but particularly a president whose election might be welcomed by our society, over the policy, and especially the internal management policy, of the federal government. The bottom line is that people are policy, personnel are policy in every branch of the government. The identity of who is making decisions and taking action is often more decisive than the ground rules of what decisions or action they're taking. And it is the existing system serves to frustrate presidential control of personnel management, and therefore the people's control of personnel management.